The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Michael Shulman is a staff writer covering pop culture of all kinds, and he's interviewed an amazing roster of talent. In the past couple of years, it includes Peter Dinklage, Parker Posey, Frank Oz, and recently, none other than the great Pam Grier.
Pam Grier has a very unique place in popular culture because she emerged in the 1970s as the heroine of a genre usually called blaxploitation. And these were black action movies that were like nothing else that had come before.
This is skinny. Before you start talking tough, I better warn you, I got a black belt in karate. So why don't you get out of here quietly? They still got some teeth left in that ugly face.
They're outrageous, they're raunchy, they have sex and violence and drugs. While there had been movies before she came around, like Shaft and Superfly, she was the first female heroine of this genre. She's so much fun to watch and was sexy and funny and empowered and really like no one else who had been in movies.
This is California.
It's supposed to be warm.
We were on the set of Bless This Mess, which is a sitcom about a city couple that moves to a small Nebraska town to be farmers. And Pam plays a woman who owns the general store and is also the town sheriff.
Y'all had an intruder?
What? Oh, hey! Yes, I called 911, but that was last night. You're just coming now?
Believe it or not, there isn't a code for a dead chicken. You can't call the sheriff when a chicken dies, just like you can't call a gynecologist when the internet goes dead.
Now, I want to point out that even though you're not actually filming any scenes today, you are still dressed as if you could be sheriff of a small town.
I dress like this all the time.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Did I offend you?
It's amazing.
The smell of leather.
Hmm.
It's deer hide.
Why did you come here to Hollywood and what were your first impressions of it?
Another planet. It's nirvana. It's like a place you, from where I've been, you know, military bases and all my childhood, and the only place I had a beautiful outdoors experience was at the farm in Wyoming, and it was just dirt and the gray barn, you know, and then to come out to California and drive down Sunset Boulevard, I said, if I can just stay here, this is what I want to do. And I met some film students who were loading up a van of cables and cameras, and I had on a plaid shirt, kind of probably the same Levi's and the same Timberland boots that I have on now. And that's all I had.
About 10 years ago, she wrote an autobiography called Foxy, which is now being developed as a biopic. And in it, she revealed that she had been the victim of sexual assault multiple times, starting when she was 6 and then again when she was 18. And she talks about how that experience made her withdraw into herself. She was extremely shy. She developed a post-traumatic stutter. And she saw her own attractiveness as a real danger.
I didn't find myself sexy or pretty. I didn't even shave my legs.
You know, it's tricky because I think her image in those movies like Foxy Brown were so empowering for women and so alluring, I'm sure, for men who just thought she was hot. And she was coming up at the time of, you know, Black Power and Angela Davis. And she was kind of the pop culture version of that.
By a patriarchal society that allowed it, it was okay to slap your mom or push women around or berate them or the food wasn't right. You would see that in many families. And that was the nature of the beast back in the 50s and 60s.
Hmm. So your characters like Foxy Brown and Coffee were obviously so empowering and
witty
and fun. Part of what I love about those movies is that you could tell that they were doing things in all kinds of exploitation movies that they couldn't have done in movies just a few years before. There were some black critics who—
Very conservative black critics.
Who thought that it was perpetuating stereotypes of drug dealers and pimps and everything.
I kept telling them, where do you think we get them from? Those aren't stereotypes. We get them from reality. When a woman takes out her earrings and her shoes, she's going to whoop your behind. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's in my movies. Okay, and certain cultures understand that. And other cultures would think it's black exploitation. It's exploitation. We don't fight. We're conservative. Black people, we don't do that. The hell you don't.
One of her biggest fans from the 70s was Quentin Tarantino, who in 1997 cast her as Jackie Brown. Jackie Brown is a caper based on an Elmore Leonard novel called Rum Punch, but Quentin Tarantino wanted her to be in the movie so bad that he actually changed the main character from a white blonde woman to a black woman.
Well, I've seen Quentin Tarantino point out that one thing he loved about your movies is that you didn't have an equivalent in white cinema. There was no white girl action hero. It was you. And I thought that was an amazing observation that you were just a true original.
It was interesting because my mom had a lot of white women friends and they weren't allowed to speak back to their husbands like a black woman would. It was different in culture. Hey, we both go through so much discrimination and oppression. I'm not going to let you talk to me that way.
Right.
And there's not that oppression in a white family.
Can I ask you something about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Because I was amazed at, first of all, the fact that you were dating him before either of you were really famous, but also that he was converting to Islam at the time and wanted you to be his, you know, submissive Muslim wife.
His first wife. I want to be first and the last.
So, but the two lives that you were choosing between essentially were so different. And you say that you really struggled with that decision. How did you decide what path to take?
I decided on me. Because I'd seen being married and validated by men in marriage. Some people fall in love with the idea of being in a marriage. Yeah, but if he decides to take it away from you, how do you hang on to it?
And this decision came down to this one incredible moment when he called you up and said, I'm marrying someone tomorrow unless you—
No,
come
today.
Over. Today?
When he called me on my birthday and he says, so, I want to be able to give you your Muslim name. And I'm going, okay. You've had 3 months to decide, and I've given you the books. I'm here at the temple, and if you don't commit to marrying me and becoming a Muslim woman, I will marry someone this afternoon who's been prepared for me. Without all of that, he was the perfect. He loved jazz. He loved sports. He was an academic. He was just perfect for me. He could have been that first love.
Yeah.
But at that, that day, he kind of took the eraser and went, and I said, okay, but I couldn't make him happy. He was so happy when he talked about his conversion and the religion. And I said, God, he just beams. I walk in the room, I don't make him beam like that. I don't make him, you know, be that happy.
In the mid-70s, she was in a relationship with the comedian Richard Pryor, who was at the height of his fame, but also very deeply in the middle of his drug problems as well. And Greer tried to be a positive force in his life, but ultimately, as she writes in her book, the relationship deteriorated. And the end of this relationship is particularly surreal, and I wanted to hear about this story, which was that Pryor was gifted a miniature horse, and he thought he should keep it around because Pam loved horses.
I come home, I get the call, and the horse is bleeding and has been attacked, and I'm going, and Richard's going to fall off the wagon. He's going to be so depressed, and he's been really good. He has no drugs, no drinking. I got to see a good side of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was nice to see that. I just knew there's going to be a bad time if this horse dies. And I saw him really, really love animals. He was sobbing from the core of his body like you'd never seen. And I said, we got to go. He says, I don't have a horse trailer. The vet can't come. We got to put Ginger in the back seat. But it's a Jaguar. Shut up. Let's go. Stop crying. Push. I pull. She got in and she was on her knees, her head out the window, tail out the back. The car went down, hit the asphalt, the pipes. I thought it was going to break down, the axle break. And he's get in the car. He's in his bathrobe, barefoot, and he's crying. I'm like, oh my God, Richard's going to have a heart attack. The horse is going to die, and I'm going to get in an accident on the freeway. So
I'd also like to point out that anyone passing your car would have seen Pam Grier at the driver's seat, Richard Pryor crying in a bathrobe in the passenger seat, and then just horse hooves like flying out of the back seat. That is nuts.
Yes, it was. And the vet said, we're all going to be outside when you drive up because we want to see this. They gave her anesthesia and stitches and surgery and everything, and she survived. And Richard said, you know what? You're funnier than I am. He said, I said, that's the purity of where I come from, country. We're going to take care of what we have to take care of.
Well, it's a real honor and a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for your interest and your consideration.
Pam Grier. She spoke with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman on the set of ABC's Bless This Mess in Santa Clarita, California. And we should note that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's relationship to Islam and gender relations have evolved since he was in his 20s.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.